Al Jazeera Podcasts.
Today, the meaning of Easter in Palestine. As many Christians around the world mark the holiday Good Friday, we speak to a pastor in Bethlehem.
In Palestine, we say that our Good Friday has lasted way too long.
I'm Malika Bilal, and this is The Take.
So my name is Munzer Ishaq, and I'm the pastor of the Evangelical Lutheran Christmas Church here in Bethlehem in Palestine. And I'm also the academic dean of Bethlehem Bible College.
Which makes you Reverend Dr. Munzer Ishaq. And it's a pleasure to have you. Welcome to The Take. So Reverend, I want to start at the beginning, because you grew up in Bethlehem, where Jesus is believed to have been born. But I've heard you mention that living in the birthplace of Jesus isn't the first thing that comes to mind when you're asked what it was like growing up there. What is the first thing that comes to mind?
The occupation defines a lot of our reality. And yes, many Western Christians are fascinated with the idea that I was born in Bethlehem. I'm actually speaking to you literally 5 minutes away from the Church of the Nativity where Jesus was born. But that's not what comes to mind first when I think of my past growing up in Bethlehem. What I remember most from my childhood is the First Intifada, is the curfews, is the demonstrations outside of our house. Some personal experiences that, you know, quite honestly, I don't like to remember, like lying down on the floor when there is shooting outside of our house, or once even being slapped by a soldier. You know, this is what I remember as a 10 years old, 9 years old. He slapped me in my face. It's these kind of memories that, for us Palestinians, we are still living them. And the sad reality is that my children are living this too. As we go through checkpoints now on a daily basis, it looks different now. With our life now is more about checkpoints, the separation wall. The occupation is still here. Let's not forget that. And let's not pretend that what's happening in Palestine is a conflict. This is one of the biggest misconceptions people have about the situation in Palestine, namely that it is a conflict. It's not a conflict. Mm-hmm. It's a reality of oppression and apartheid that we're still living on a daily basis.
Thank you for that reminder. Bethlehem, of course, as you know, and your congregation knows, is also a city where the Christian population, like across the rest of Palestine, has been on a decline. You talked about the occupation still being there and still being a daily reality. How has it affected how you practice your religion and lead your church?
The biggest challenge we face right now is our young people immigrating, our young families immigrating and choosing to live a life outside of Palestine that is devoid of the challenges of the occupation.
The number of Palestinian Christians is dwindling. Here in the occupied West Bank and in East Jerusalem, there are around 50,000. On the other side of the Israeli wall, there are around 130,000 with Israeli citizenship. And in Gaza, there's less than 1,000.
We live in this constant fear that one day Bethlehem will be coming to a museum of just historic old churches. Many of my congregants in my church, the older generation, their children have already left. It's really impossible to thrive as a community here, given the restrictions and the many interruptions in our lives. We don't have any economy to rely on. We're not a state to have a stable or functioning economy. And Israel controls basically everything outside of our towns and villages, from the land to the roads. And this resulting in suffocating our lives into crowded cities with no possibility of a natural expansion for us as a community. There's basically nowhere to live. nowhere to build, nowhere to expand. And I fully understand why people make the decision to leave. I wish they would not, but this is the reality. And I speak to you from Bethlehem. Bethlehem is literally, what, 10 miles from Jerusalem? Even less. I remember as a child when we used to take a bus and in 15 minutes we are in Jerusalem. Mm-hmm. Right now we're not allowed to go to Jerusalem. Right now you have a whole generation of Palestinians who live in Bethlehem who've never seen Jerusalem. Can you think of that? And for us as Christians, Jerusalem and Bethlehem are like two sister cities. It's the holy month of Ramadan now, and you know, my Muslim neighbors are not able to go to Al-Aqsa Mosque because of these restrictions. And we will celebrate Easter soon. And similarly, we're not able to go to the Church of the Holy Sepulchre. And by the way, even the Jerusalemites themselves, the Palestinians in Jerusalem, are not allowed, you know, there are restrictions for them to go to the church itself.
Tense moments during Orthodox Easter weekend in the old city of Jerusalem, as thousands of Christians who flocked from around the world to this holy site kept out by Israeli police.
And this is, again, this is not something new. This has all been happening. The whole world knew about it, but sadly, no one is doing anything to stop it.
So what you're describing is what it looks like in the occupied West Bank. Meanwhile, in Gaza, we know that Israel has been targeting churches, killing civilians, sheltering inside of them. The Palestinian Christian community in Gaza is one of the oldest in the world, and it's believed that less than 1,000 Christians remain there. So if this war continues, does the Christian community in Gaza face an existential threat?
I think we've already given into the idea that this war of genocide, let's call it for what it is, will bring an end to the Christian presence in Gaza, which was already a fragile Christian presence as a result of the 16, now 17 years of blockade.
My brothers went to Latin church, but two sisters went to the Greek Orthodox church. The first shelling was to the Greek Orthodox immediately. Not as they said around it, no, immediately.
I want to leave my house and what's left of my country and go somewhere else outside of Gaza for safety and security of my family. This hasn't crossed my mind before. Now I want to leave with my family, and after the war, I'll think about my options and whether I'll ever come back again.
In this war, no place is safe. Every place has been targeted, from churches to mosques to hospitals to schools to UNRWA buildings. And even women walking in the vicinity of the church, within the church compound, two women were shot dead.
A mother and daughter taking shelter inside a church in northern Gaza have been killed by Israeli snipers. Some witnesses say the women were shot in cold blood at the Holy Family Catholic Church.
This is a war against all Palestinians. We've been saying it from the very beginning. It's a vengeance campaign. We speak to the Christian community now in Gaza, and the majority of them are seeking refuge in one of the two churches, living in horrible situations. And on top of that, there is the trauma that their life could end at literally any second from a bomb or a sniper. And we're not just hyper-exaggerating. You know, this is the reality. And then the other trauma of knowing that their fate is unknown because their homes were destroyed. And so in their despair, they tell us, you know, can you find us a place if we're able to leave Gaza after this war? So you cannot guarantee anything, actually. You cannot guarantee that they will be allowed to go to their homes.
So, Reverend, your Christmas sermon last year made headlines around the world.
If Jesus were to be born today, he would be born under the rubble in Gaza.
Now, about 3 months later, how are you preparing to speak to your congregation ahead of the upcoming Easter holiday?
My prayer, my wish is that I won't have to speak about Gaza or the genocide or to call for this genocide to end. It's hard to believe that it's been Christmas and now Easter and before that Lent season. And Easter for us as Palestinian Christians is a time to reflect on first the suffering of Jesus. at the heart of the meaning in the Christian faith is the cross. And the cross is the symbol not just of suffering, but of violence under the hand of a ruthless empire. It was a way of execution.
Christians worldwide are marking Good Friday in commemoration of the crucifixion of Jesus Christ. Christians believe on this day, Jesus sacrificed himself for their sins.
Jesus is taken away with two other accused criminals and nailed to a Roman execution device. And people are mocking him.
And he even prayed for his executors. Father, forgive them. They don't know what they're doing.
And in a very sad way, we see again Jesus in solidarity with us. You know, when we say we as Palestinians see Jesus as one of us, I'm not trying to make a political statement. When we read the gospel narrative about someone who was killed in a brutal way for his beliefs and for his activism by an empire, suffering, and then crying on the cross, my God, why have you forsaken me? We identify, or we see Jesus identifying with us through his death on the cross. And then when it comes to the core message of the Christian faith, the resurrection, we talk of Good Friday, the day in which Jesus was crucified, as a very dark day, as a very sad occasion. If you walk in Bethlehem or in Jerusalem during Good Friday, you will hear Fairuz singing the hymns of Easter. Very sad hymns about the death of Jesus. In Palestine, we say that our Good Friday has lasted way too long. We've been living in sorrow for way too long. But Easter reminds us that the final word belongs to God. The final word is that of justice, is that of truth, is that of life. Maybe part of our Palestinian resilience, Palestinian sumud, is this experience of enduring many empires. And maybe part of our Palestinian Christian resilience is our belief in the God of the resurrection and in our belief that ultimately goodness, righteousness, justice will prevail. And if you believe this, you will not live in despair.
After the break, what Reverend Mundhir wants Christians around the world to know as they celebrate Easter.
Welcome to Necessary Tomorrows. My name is Ursula. I am an AI. And I have inferred from your online activity that you have been feeling more dread than hope when you think about the future that is coming for us here in the 2060s. So I have created a course just for you to enhance your capacity for imagining different futures. Necessary Tomorrows, an audio series by Doha Debates and Al Jazeera. Find it where you listen to podcasts.
A quick reminder before we get back to our show. If you're listening to The Take on Google Podcasts, starting April 2nd, the app will no longer be available. So find us on YouTube Music, Spotify, Castbox, or any other podcast platform. So, Reverend, I want to talk about another reason why your name was in the headlines recently, and that is because the Archbishop of Canterbury, Justin Welby, who's the leader of the Church of England, refused to meet with you when you were in the UK. And it was a move many described as appalling, among other things. He later apologized, changed his position.
As a religious leader, I can say that the killing of so many civilians, the extensive damage to civilian infrastructure, cannot be morally justified.
You did eventually meet with him. Talk to me about the evolution of that interaction and why it matters. Why did it make headlines?
I think it made headlines because of the timing and because of, I think people knew who I was. Since my Christmas sermon and the Jesus Under the Rubble grotto that we made in our church. My visit to the UK was well publicized, and I spoke in one of the rallies, and that in itself was a profound experience that confirmed to me that both people in the streets and in the churches do not agree with their governments or church leaders. There's this big gap. But this was not the first time I experienced this as a Palestinian Christian leader. I think this is the first time it was well publicized. And to his credit, this was the first time a Western Christian leader apologized for refusing to meet with us or for canceling a speaking engagement, which is something that happened to many of us as Palestinian Christian leaders. So ultimately we met, and I think there was a lot of pressure. I think his words of apology were very genuine. It was a very grace and mercy-filled meeting. He acknowledged that his positions in the past did not get our story, and that now he sees things after this genocide maybe in a different way after months and months. And I continued to challenge him just as I challenged many other Christian leaders, because I don't want to make this as an encounter between as if two individuals. I think to me as a Palestinian Christian leader, the issue has more to do with the position of many churches in the West who I didn't hesitate saying they were complicit, whether through their silence or in some cases defense of the Israeli narrative. And to me as a Christian leader, I cannot accept this. Mm-hmm. If we as Christians believe and call all the time that God is love and God is mercy, God is compassion, God is justice, yet are careful in our statements or positions or activism. I'm tired of statements. I want churches to act. So I challenged him, please put pressure on your government. I invited him to come to Palestine. I mean, come and demand a ceasefire. We have a responsibility as faith leaders to speak loudly, and we have a platform, and we must use this platform for the good of humanity.
From an outsider's perspective, what boggles my mind is that there seems to be a disconnect between care and love and recognition of the people in the land where Christianity was born. What have you heard personally from other Christian leaders? Have you felt more solidarity globally or more dismissed?
No, I think we are witnessing an increased solidarity from Christians around the world, whether in the global south or even in the north. Let's not forget that many Christians have called from the very beginning for a ceasefire, and many churches have taken strong stance. I look at the Christian spectrum. There are, you know, on both sides, there are Christian Zionists who still support this war. And there are those who have been coming to Palestine in show of solidarity. And I've been receiving thousands of messages on the different social media platforms of people who fully get it, and they're not happy with the positions of their political leaders or even church leaders. Yes, there are still those who don't know much, and there are still those who don't know that Palestinian Christians exist. I know that. But when it comes to the church leaders or the diplomats and the politicians, at least those I meet with, they know everything. And that's why I said during my visit is that what I feel leaders lack in our world today, especially our politicians, what they lack is courage and integrity to act upon what they know.
Reverend, we're speaking before Easter. What do you want people who are marking the holiday to keep in mind as they celebrate, wherever they are in the world?
Well, first, I want them to remember that the gospel stories they read about did not happen in a different universe. They happened in real places. And that there are Christians in those places even today. Christians who are still walking the Via della Rosa, the road of suffering and pain, the way of injustice. And our Easter celebration is really meaningless if we don't think and pray for others who are going through these hard experiences. Sadly, many Christians around the world think of these religious holidays in a very individualistic way. But we cannot stop there. We have to think of others. We have to remember that many are still victims of the very same violence that Jesus suffered from when he walked in this very same land 2,000 years ago. And, you know, as we think of the idea of the resurrection in the Middle East, all Middle Eastern Christians We greet one another on Easter Sunday with the words Al-Masih Qam, which means Christ is risen. And may this be a dua, a call for the triumphant of life and of truth and righteousness to all. And may this be, you know, may we celebrate Easter. This is my only prayer. It's a good reminder, as I said, that ultimately the final word belongs to God. And when you go through difficulties, and I can't even imagine what the people in Gaza are going through right now, we lose sight of the idea that, you know, we might think that this injustice, this tyranny would last forever. But I want to remind people that, as I said, the final word is always for God. And because of that, we will have hope. In my Christmas sermon, I said that I'm confident that we as Palestinians will rise. We will recover. And to me, as a Palestinian Christian, that Easter Sunday is one important source of that hope that I have.
Well, amen. Ameen. Reverend Dr. Mundhir Ishaq, thank you for this conversation and happy Easter.
Thank you.
And that's The Take. This episode was produced by Khalid Sultan with Zaina Badr, Miranda Lin, Amy Walters, Ashish Malhotra, Chloe K. Lee, David Enders, Berenice Campana, Nagin Awliyai, Saril Khalili, Sonia Bagat, and me, Malika Bilal. Our sound designer is Alex Roldan. Joe Plord mixed this episode. Alexandra Locke is The Take's executive producer, and Nay Alvarez is Al Jazeera's head of audio. We'll be back.